On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I am Bob Garrett, your moderator. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guests. Dr. Tsuneo Akaha is a professor of international policy at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He specializes in Japanese foreign and security policy, international relations of the Asia Pacific, international political economy, and international marine affairs. He came to the United States as an exchange student during high school. He was a Fulbright scholar at the University of Tokyo and Seikei University, and a Japan Foundation Research Fellow at Hokkaido University's Slavic Research Center. He is a visiting professor at the University of Shimane. He has served as president of Asian Studies on the Pacific Coast and of Comparative Interdisciplinary Studies Section of the International Studies Association. Moving down the line, we have Dr. Barnett Barron, who I guess I got it backwards here, who began serving as Give to Asia's president and CEO in April 2011. Previously, he served as executive vice president for the Asia Foundation. He represented the Asia Foundation on several committees of the Council on Foundations and was a key member of a council task force set up to negotiate with the Treasury Department on appropriate anti-terrorist funding guidelines. In 1991, Dr. Barron served as a visiting scholar at the East Asian Institute at Columbia University. In 1994, he co-founded the Asia Pacific Philanthropy Consortium and served for several years as its chairman. Before 1991, Mr. Barron was vice president for international programs at Save the Children, senior representative for East and South Asia for the Population Council based in Bangkok, and taught political science and research methods at Columbia University. Dr. Stephen Vogel, our last speaker, is professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. He specializes in the political economy of advanced industrialized nations, especially Japan. He is author of Japan Remodeled: How Government and Industry Are Reforming Japanese Capitalism, among others. He has written extensively on comparative political economy and Japanese politics, industrial policy, trade and defense policy, and other topics. He has worked as a reporter for the Japan Times in Tokyo and as a freelance journalist in France. He has taught previously at the University of California, Irvine, and also Harvard University. Here to discuss political, economic, and humanitarian implications of the disaster in Japan, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Drs. Akaha, Barron, and Vogel. So the first question to Dr. Barron. Dr. Barron, having recently returned from Japan where you met with Japanese officials, actually we're going to start with speaking, right? Sorry about that. I believe.
Shall I go?
You should go.
Okay. How much time do I have? 7 minutes, something like
7 minutes.
Okay. Good evening. Let me begin by saying that Give to Asia is a nonprofit organization based here in San Francisco that advocates for and facilitates philanthropic giving to Asia. We work with individuals, families, foundations, and corporations, and provide services to match their philanthropic interest with qualified grantees across Asia. We work closely with the Asia Foundation, which has 18 resident offices across Asia, and that enables us a pretty broad reach to conduct due diligence, to identify issues, to actually manage grants, and to report back to donors. We were established a decade ago, and at that time we have facilitated about $160 million in grants to more than 1,000 qualified Asian organizations. My Give to Asia colleague, Jillian Yeo, who's sitting in the audience, and I visited Iwate and Miyagi prefectures in Japan, the earthquake and tsunami affected area, earlier this month for about 10 days. Jillian's pictures are on slideshow out in the lobby, and you can see some of the pictures we took, actually she took, about a week ago. So I'm very pleased and honored to be able to present some of our impressions based on that trip. I'm going to speak around 6 or 7 major points and elaborate a bit on each of those. And then if you have questions, be happy to elaborate on more specifics. The first point is that this is still an emergency situation 3 months after the earthquake and tsunami. A few days after the event, there were pictures in the New York Times and elsewhere showing a comparison between a road that had been totally severed during the earthquake and 3 days later when it had been repaired. And I think this created the impression that Japanese technology is going to take care of this pretty quickly. But as we saw just 2 weeks ago, there are literally mile after mile of devastation and debris all along the northeast coast of Japan. These are wooden buildings, concrete buildings, major equipment, rubble. The pictures tell the story. But this is by no means a resolved set of issues. The Japanese self-defense forces are still searching for survivors. I'm sorry, still searching for victims. And we were told that they still find anywhere from 1 to 3 a day in this area, which is a very extensive area. I understand that the linear extent is about from Chicago to Memphis, Tennessee. It's a long area of destruction. Rodents, flies, pests are beginning to be a real problem. After all, this was a seacoast active in fishing. There are lots of dead fish. There are lots of dead animals. And these pests are becoming a significant problem, particularly as the rainy season begins. There are, believe it or not, a substantial number of people living in partially devastated homes where the first floors have been washed out, but the second floor is still livable. And so amidst all of this devastation, you still have several thousand people who prefer to be in their own homes than to go to centers. Finally, on this point, some coastal areas have literally subsided by a meter or more and are now underwater. Some beaches that used to be tremendous tourist attractions are now reduced to their base rubble. And some areas are submerged or, I'm sorry, inundated during high tides, but free during low tides. All of these present major logistical problems and have this remain an emergency area. Secondly, at the beginning of the, or right after March 11, approximately 500,000 people were in emergency evacuation centers. That's now down to somewhere between 100 and 125,000 people. Some people have left for permanent settlement. Others are beginning to move into temporary housing. The temporary housing presents problems of its own. It provides privacy. Some of them are they're all very well stocked with kitchen equipment and air conditioning and TVs, but there isn't very much free land available in Japan. So many of these temporary housing units are in pretty isolated areas. It's not yet clear how people will get around, how people will get to them, how they will be able to find jobs and markets, et cetera. The recipients in this temporary housing do not have to pay rent, but they do have to pay for services and utilities. And many of them are quite old and no longer employed. And so there are problems about being able to pay. They're expected to leave this temporary housing after 2 years. So this is based on a model of the Kobe earthquake in 1995. But Kobe was a relatively compact urban area, and temporary housing was within that urban area. We're now talking about an extensive geographic area where a lot of the temporary housing is isolated geographically and isolated from the communities from which people come. So there are other problems. The next point is that I was surprised to see how little actual demographic data there are on the victims. Evacuation centers could tell you how many people they fed that day, but really couldn't give a very good breakdown on age, gender, employment history, educational levels, and it only covers people in the centers, not the thousands of people who are living in their cars, in makeshift housing, or in their own partially damaged housing. So for planning purposes, I kept asking, how many people, who are they? We don't really know. What we do know is that Tohoku, the area in which the earthquake and tsunami occurred, has been a relatively economically depressed area for several decades, Many of the younger people and younger families have left for employment. Therefore, disproportionately, the elderly, people over 65, and in Japan, over 70 or 75, have been left behind. So without having demographic data, we don't know precisely who we're dealing with and whether we're talking about a hard core of people who are going to have long-term care needs that need to be addressed. Among the NGOs we spoke to, our partners and others, there was a general acknowledgement of a lack of strategic leadership. Investment and reconstruction plans are still uncertain. Which areas are going to be rebuilt? When? Which areas are going to be open for private development? Which areas are just going to be left? This is particularly true in small harbors, coastal towns, areas where there were family-oriented fishing businesses. Just not clear. We're still waiting for the Japanese government to come up with a reconstruction plan that is backed by, one, political will, and two, money. There have been some announcements about compensation policies, but we're all still waiting for a framework for reconstruction. Many of the NGOs we spoke to don't know how long they're going to stay. They say, well, we'll be here about a year, which means until April. But what's magic about that time? What will the needs be? Who do you talk to? How do you do long-term planning in the absence of data, in the absence of policy? It's a real issue. From a donor's perspective, this is my next point, the Japanese nonprofit sector is relatively underdeveloped for a host of historical reasons. It was relatively easier to find experienced NGOs in Aceh, Indonesia, after the December 2004 tsunami than it is to find well-established staffed NGOs in Japan today. Many Japanese NGOs are able to manage volunteers, and I was quite impressed by their ability to do that efficiently. People who come up for 2 or 3 days at a time, and finding productive work for them to do is an art. It's a management skill. I was very impressed. But in terms of professional staffing, or the track record to provide long-term assistance, very limited in Japan. We have to look, we as a donor, have to look beyond the NGO sector for professional organizations to meet longer-term needs in medical health, in medical care, mental health care, geriatric care, legal aid, restarting small businesses. These are not areas in which it's easy to find Japanese nonprofit organizations that have a track record or skills. They're used to managing volunteers. Our strategy, Give to Asia's strategy, in disaster situations is that we're not on the ground and we have to raise money. We're an intermediary, remember. And so it takes a little time. So we are not a first responder. Typically, we would allocate about 10% of the funds that we raise to support immediate relief through local organizations, and about 10% for sort of transitional activities, but the bulk of it, 75-80%, for long-term reconstruction. And that's what we're doing here. To date, we have spent a little more than $350,000 in grants already made to Japanese organizations for immediate relief activities. We have an interesting pipeline which goes beyond the NGO sector. We're talking to the medical schools of two universities in the affected area for mental health outreach programs over the next 3 years. We are trying to find law associations, legal firms, law schools, or others who can provide legal aid. In situations like this, in other countries at least, there are problems of establishing your eligibility for government compensation, problems of establishing your ownership of land, problems of establishing your rights to sell or buy, especially if developers start coming in. And typically, these are the kinds of legal aid requirements that disaster victims have felt in other countries. We assume it'll be the same in Japan. We're interested in supporting efforts to recapitalize or restart small businesses. We have to find partners who are able to do that. It's not exactly microfinance, it's bigger than that, but people who have the capacity to jumpstart small businesses that have been destroyed.
We also had a very interesting discussion with a local group that is in the process of establishing something like a community foundation that will be raising money from local, from Japanese individuals, corporations, foundations, as well as international donors to make grants to local organizations for long-term disaster assistance. So we're looking for activities that have more long-term implication and that have long-term projects. Final point, and this I think takes us into Professor Vogel's presentation, the 600-pound elephant, what nobody talked about until I pushed, and that was Fukushima and the nuclear plants. Among the people we spoke to, in government, NGOs, others, widespread lack of trust in the government. They don't believe that what they're being told is the full story or even an accurate story. And they certainly don't believe TEPCO, the Tohoku Economic Power Company. And in retrospect, they're right. What we're hearing now is very different from what we were originally told. So this represents an extensive failure of corporate governance on the part of the company involved and on the part of the government in terms of independent regulation and supervision of the nuclear industry. I'm not an expert in this area, but it's just glaringly obvious to me in the conversations that we had. And finally, the nuclear plants were the economic drivers of this economically depressed area. What's going to replace them? They got there in the first place because no one wanted to invest. Who's going to replace them now? So I will stop. I think I've gone over my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Barron.
Let's go to Dr. Vogel. Dr. Vogel, could you comment on the effects and implications that the natural disasters and the situation of the Fukushima Daiichi power plant have had on Japanese politics and government policy?
I can certainly try. So how would we expect a disaster of this magnitude to reshape politics? I would suggest we might expect two kinds of changes. First, we might expect that partisan politics would be at least moderated somewhat, and that politicians would, if not eliminate, at least decrease their squabbling and focus on the big picture of what needs to be done. Second, and related, we might expect that kind of the usual political gridlock would be overcome and the government would have some sort of a window of opportunity to actually get things done. So have we seen these two kinds of changes in Japan? My answer would be yes, but much less than we would have hoped. So let me try to be a little bit more precise, taking on each of these points in turn. First, have they moved from partisan politics to more cooperation? Very much in the shortest possible term. And this is actually pretty easy to follow, because if we look at what was the situation in politics right before the earthquake, Prime Minister Kan's support ratings were at an all-time low, about 20%. The opposition was calling for him to resign. Most people thought his days were numbered. After the earthquake, there was the briefest, right, of respite from this criticism. In other words, that he had a new leash on life, but it was a very short one, right? His support ratings went up. There was a lot of rhetoric of cooperation. We have to get beyond this political fighting and find out what's best for Japan in this crisis situation. However, The perception was very quickly that the Prime Minister was not doing a very good job of managing this crisis. The information dissemination was poor, right? The government wasn't being forthright about a nuclear crisis. It was not acting decisively enough. It was moving too slowly. And there was poor coordination and a lack of leadership from the top. And so very quickly, the gloves came off. And the opposition attacked so much to the point that on June 2nd, the opposition actually put forward a motion of no confidence in the government. Now, normally in a parliamentary system, this shouldn't be a problem because the government, by definition, has a majority in the lower house of the parliament, and so they should be able to win. But members of Prime Minister Khan's own party threatened to vote with the opposition, which would have brought the government down, and they would have had to call an election. So in a sense, it was a game of chicken among members of the Democratic Party of Japan, which is governing Japan. So in a truly bizarre deal, the opponents of Prime Minister Khan within his own party agreed not to vote with the opposition, right, if Prime Minister Khan would agree to resign sometime soon. Now, oddly enough, this deal actually went forward. So the no confidence motion was rejected because the Democratic Party of Japan held firm. They voted with the Prime Minister, but the understanding was that the Prime Minister's was then his job was to resign, although there was some disagreement, and certainly great disagreement now, about exactly when he is supposed to quit. He has since clarified this point within the past few days, and he says that he is going to resign once three conditions are met. First, the legislature has to pass the second extraordinary spending bill for reconstruction. Second, it has to pass a bill that will allow the government to issue more deficit bonds, which will allow them to pass future budgets. And third, his third condition is that he wants the legislature to pass a bill that will push Japan more towards renewable energy sources. So in this sense, he's kind of shown his cards, is that he wants to be known, if he's going to go out, he will at least be known as the Prime Minister who has nudged Japan, right, not off of nuclear power, because that's impossible, but away from nuclear power and towards at least promoting some more renewable sources of energy. So that's the current deal, but that leaves lots of questions unanswered. Second question I raised was, is the government actually getting things done? And here we've got some modest progress. The first spending bill did pass. The government has created a reconstruction design panel that has issued a report. They've just created a new reconstruction headquarters. There was a minor cabinet reshuffle just this past Monday, where they created a new ministerial position of reconstruction ministry, a minister and a ministry. And there is, at the very least, the government is seriously discussing two of the big questions that are going to govern its future. One is, how are they going to pay for all of this? And the answer in the short term is through borrowing. And through the medium to long term is they're going to have to increase taxes. And in the Japanese context, that will probably mean consumption or sales taxes, which are very low by international standards, but not a popular thing, as you can imagine. And the second is what to do about Japan's energy future. No big decisions have been made, but Prime Minister Khan has said he wants to move the country where by the early 2020s, the country would have more than 20% of its energy would come from renewable sources. So in the short term, it's really amazing how quickly the mood of cooperation, which lasted a number of days, has been eroded, and how while both the governing party and the opposition are talking about cooperation, like let's not get bogged down by this infighting, there are more important things. So that rhetoric is very much there. But the reality is that they are acting on the basis of tactical maneuvers and, you know, how are they going to position themselves for the next election. So that's really actually quite disappointing. There's a big question marks, as I suggested, about what comes next. When will the Prime Minister resign? The current, I guess, median bet is late August, but it could come sooner. It could come as late as early next year. When he does, who will be the next Prime Minister? There's already obviously some maneuvering going on within his party. There's also talk of the possibility of a grand coalition, meaning a government that would be both the governing party and the primary opposition party would both be part of the government, and you would have the cabinet ministers actually formed out of both. The idea would be this would offer the opportunity for real collaboration. And this is what the opposition is saying. Well, maybe if we did this, for example, then we could get past this partisan bickering. But there I just have to insert a little realism as a political scientist. What we know about grand coalitions is that they don't work very well, right? Because you still have to figure out what you're going to do, right? And so even if you're both part of the government, that it changes the framework of the squabbling, but it doesn't mean that you have some sort of magic consensus on what should be done. So having left you with on a kind of a depressing note, let me try to insert just a little bit of optimism. I don't have much optimism for the very near term because I think this chaos is going to continue. But in the midterm, I'm a little bit more optimistic, and I'll suggest two reasons why. The first is that the Democratic Party took power in 2009. It was really the first real time, except for one brief period in 93, 94, when there had been any party in power other than the Liberal Democratic Party. So what that means is that Japan has moved towards competitive politics, right? They've moved from one party rule to at least the possibility of some kind of real competition. Unfortunately, in the short term, this competition has not worked out real well because the Democratic Party has not been very effective in governing. And even more disappointing, the LDP in opposition has not articulated a real difference. It said, you know, this is what we stand for. Nonetheless, I'm optimistic in the medium term because I think that the competitive dynamic is going to eventually kick in, that as you move towards the next lower house election, the LDP, which is currently in opposition, will have to articulate some sort of difference, say this is what we're going to do. That will force the DPJ, and I don't want to be overly optimistic, but I think you'll start to see some sort of policy debate in that first or the next lower house election, and even more in the one following that. The second thing is that I don't think that people are going to forget this particular crisis very quickly. And so that means that even as this current drama unfolds, we get a new prime minister, let's say, and some sort of a new government, a new cabinet, there's still going to be pressure to address the big questions, maybe in a way that there wasn't prior to the earthquake. People are going to be saying, look, enough nonsense. How are you going to deal with the problem of our energy future? How are you going to pay for the programs, right? And there's some other big issues that are lingering. Obviously, productivity, economic growth, welfare. And so because of the competitive dynamic, plus the kind of the opportunity that this crisis raises, I think there's some reason to believe that the government in a year or two is going to feel like it has to come up with answers.
Dr. Vogel, thank you very much. Our final speaker, Dr. Kaha. We've just heard from Dr. Vogel a bit about the effect that these unfortunate incidents have had on the Japanese government domestically. But how have these events challenged Japan in the international arena?
Thank you very much for this opportunity to follow my partners in a literal sense, in that Dr. Barron represents a Give to Asia, to which or through which the Monterey Institute has been able to make a modest donation, thanks to our students and the local people. And the Japanese students in particular who participated in the fundraising were very deeply touched by the outpouring of local people's support. And Stephen talked about the domestic political situation. Now it's my turn to talk about Japan's foreign policy and the implications and impact of the current developments on Japan's relationship with the major partners of Japan. In his article, some of you may have read this in the International Herald Tribune, Japan is Open for Business, that was the title. Japanese Foreign Minister Matsumoto wrote, "The Great East Asia, East Japan earthquake and tsunami are the worst disasters Japan has encountered since the end of the Second World War. However, Japan will not simply rebuild what used to be, but aim for an innovative reconstruction that focuses on the future by fully mobilizing its signature strength, a society with high levels of technology, safety, and security. But as has already implied or alluded to, Japan's image of itself as a country of high technology, safety, and security has been badly damaged, tarnished, not only within the international arena, but also domestically as well. Many people no longer trust Japan with all the technological resources and capacities it has. No longer many people believe that Japan is a safe society of which the government is able to protect its own citizens from natural and not so natural disasters. Japan is no longer able to protect itself in terms of international and or national security while Japan is domestically in a doldrum politically and now has to prioritize the reconstruction. And the repair is taking place right now, and that will last probably 5 to 10 years. Just to talk about financial and infrastructure redevelopment of Japan. So while Japan is internally focused, Japan's foreign policy priorities are going to be lost on the side. And that's the side of the issues that I'm going to address primarily in my brief presentation. I tell my students that if there's a possibility that you might run out of time, start with conclusions. So I'll start with conclusions. The basic question is, as a result of the March 11th events and subsequent disaster consequences of Japan, does Japan now face new sets of challenges in terms of foreign policy? Did Japan's foreign policy priorities or agenda change as a result of this? My second question is Japan capable of dealing with new or even more intensified foreign policy challenges? And the third question is, if Japan is not so capable, who is going to come to Japan's rescue? My conclusions are as follows. First, most of the urgent issues on the foreign policy front from the perspective of Japan that existed prior to 3/11 continue to exist. There really aren't dramatic shift in the foreign policy challenges and agenda of Japan as a result of the 3/11 incident and subsequent consequences. But Japan was already ineffective in dealing with those challenges vis-a-vis the United States, China, North Korea, and even Russia. And now Japan's ability, this is my answer to the second question that I pose myself, Japan's ability to deal with these continuing challenges is even more diminished. And thirdly, Japan will increasingly turn even more than in the past towards the United States, the only country that is capable and willing to embrace the need to assist Japan, first in recovering from the disasters, and assist Japan in dealing with some of the security, national security challenges that Japan continues to face. Now, for those of us who love America, this is good news. For those of us in Japan who want Japan to move back into the East Asian community, who consider that moving a little bit away from the United States is actually a good thing for Japan, this is indeed not so good news. And particularly for Japan's neighbors who have been trying to usher Japan back into the Asian fold, particularly China, this is not good news. The United States performed quite remarkably in the aftermath of the earthquake and tsunami, and even nuclear disaster, as has already been mentioned. The U.S. Operation Tomodachi has won the hearts and minds of millions of Japanese. Navy Admiral Walsh, heading this operation, stated, "In this case," and I'm quoting, "we live here," meaning Japan. "We have homes here." And he continued, "And so we want to be here side by side or one step behind wherever they would like us to be as they go through this very cathartic process. It's one we want to be in a position to support. The U.S. dispatched 19 ships, including the aircraft carrier Ronald Reagan, destroyers, amphibious landing ships, 140 aircraft, 18,000 troops for rescue and relief efforts. By April 5th, the U.S. had delivered 119 tons of food, 7,230 tons of water. The U.S. Marines in Okinawa, to which I'm going to address, in a minute, sent an amphibious landing ship and helicopters to deliver relief goods, removed debris, repaired and restored the Sendai Airport, which was incapacitated by the earthquake and tsunami, brought sunken ships off Sandiku Coast to shore, helicopters delivered emergency meals for 30,000 people, all within days of the earthquake. The U.S. also dispatched advisors in response to the Fukushima nuclear plant disaster, delivered two fire trucks, 100 radiation protective clothing, five pumps, two barges carrying fresh water, sent 150 strong personnel from the Chemical Biological Incident Response Force, and also, to the surprise of many of us who used to believe that Japan was at the forefront of robotics, the United States loaned its robot to actually move into the devastated nuclear reactor buildings to take pictures of exactly what was going on. Japanese had given up on the idea, despite somebody mentioning that Japan should have robots to be able to enter these buildings when human beings would be unable to for health reasons. The U.S. Air Force sent an unmanned reconnaissance aircraft named Global Hawk. I wish it were called Global Dove, but it was called Global Hawk, to share photos and videos for the damaged nuclear reactor buildings, of the damaged nuclear reactor buildings. Also provided a robot, as I said, to survey the damage inside nuclear reactor buildings. The U.S. and Japan formed a joint support forces at Yokota Base in Japan, with the U.S. side, as I understand it, reporting directly to the U.S. president. The U.S. side was headed by U.S. Pacific Fleet Commander that I mentioned, Admiral Patrick Walsh. This is unprecedented. That is, Japan's own security, domestic security, public safety, is now being managed by two governments, the United States government and the Japanese government. In addition, the U.S. sent 15 Marines to assist the joint staff of the Japanese Ministry of Defense in Ichigaya, Tokyo, and 50 Marines to the on-site command center of the self-defense forces established in Sendai in Tohoku. So this also indicates the extent to which the United States has inserted itself, welcomed by the Japanese, to help the Japanese reestablish its ability to protect its own citizens. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited Tokyo on April 17th, and some of you may have seen her holding hands with the Empress as they walked into the compounds of the Imperial Palace, which is unprecedented. You don't do that. But she did. And this picture portrayed the warmth of the American people supporting American government's mission to support the Japanese people. And this touched the hearts and minds of millions of Japanese. Japanese Defense Minister stated recently that the significance of stationing U.S. forces in Japan, including on Okinawa, was underscored and understood by the Japanese people in the aftermath of the quake and had brought them a greater sense of security. Now, I think he was being a little political as well, in that he wanted people in Okinawa to realize how much Japanese, including Okinawan people, should appreciate the U.S. presence. on the basis of this U.S. military and security and nonprofit organizations' support for the Japanese people in times of need, in times of crisis. I don't know if this is going to change the public mind in Okinawa in terms of the relocation of Futenma Marine Air Station to another location inside Okinawa. Okinawan people had expected this base to be removed from Okinawa altogether so that the burden would be shared by the rest of the Japanese. But that probably is not forthcoming. Moving to China's response, China also showed an outpouring of support, both at the governmental level and at the public, at the citizens level. China sent a 15-person search and rescue team in Japan's quake zone. This was in part to reciprocate the help that the Japanese military team had given to the Chinese people when the Chinese experienced a huge earthquake in Sichuan 3 years ago. The Chinese leadership's public response to the disaster in Japan reflected the sensitivity, however, with which Beijing needs to deal with Japan, even with respect to this humanitarian issue. For example, when Premier Wen Jiabao gave his annual press conference on March 15th, it was toward the very end of his remarks that he stated, and I quote, "I want to use today's opportunity to extend our deep condolences over the lost lives in this disaster and express our sincere sympathy to the Japanese people." He had spoken for almost 2 hours and then made this very brief remark at the very end of his speech, which implies that he did not really want to bring to the attention of the public the fact that the Chinese government was trying to assist Japan explicitly. I can elaborate on why that may be the case later on. But nonetheless, China quickly sent $4.5 million worth of rescue materials and promised more if necessary. Many Chinese citizens demonstrated their support and sympathies for the Japanese people, but there are some Chinese that suggested that this Chinese support for Japan will be temporary because there are other outstanding issues that would cloud the bilateral relationship. Most importantly, the territorial dispute with Japan and the history textbook and history issue that have hampered full reconciliation between the Japanese people and the Chinese people. So that issue continues despite the March 11th incident and subsequent developments. In terms of Korea's response, the Korean government's response to Japan was also very swift and remarkable and large scale, and the Japanese people appreciated it. It was visible. For example, Korea sent 53 tons of boric acid to help control the badly broken Fukushima nuclear plants, and on March 9th, delivered 100 tons of water and 6,000 blankets for the Japanese people who were living then in shelters. Korean citizens also showed strong humanitarian spirit and offered humanitarian aid to Japan. Within 3 weeks, South Korean donations reportedly amounted to a total of $46 million. In an opinion survey conducted about the same time, 76.4% of those who responded supported the idea of collecting money for and dispatching rescuers to Japan. However, the history textbook raised its ugly head. By March 28th, the international NGO in Korea, World Vision, had raised about 1.95 billion won, equivalent of 146 million yen. And they reported that the donations amounted to an average of 200 million won a day between the 15th and the 21st of March. But they began to decline since the 22nd. And dropped to 22 million won a day on the 25th of March. So what explains this drop? During this period, it was reported the Japanese government was about to approve a new series of textbooks in civic lessons, geography, and Japanese history that would reassert Japanese claims to the disputed island, known in Japan as Takeshima and in Korea as Tokto. So this territorial dispute, which continues beyond the 311 incident, has cast a dark shadow on the relationship between the two countries and between the two peoples. Let me mention very quickly Russia's response, which is very interesting, to say the least. The Russian government and people similarly showed much concern and sympathies towards the Japanese people, but there were also signs of both hypersensitivity on the part of both the government and the people of Russia, due, understandably, to the proximity of the Japanese archipelago and Russian territories, and also due to their own experience with Chernobyl. Within hours of the report of the Japanese earthquake and initial tsunami warnings, the Russian government evacuated some 11,000 residents from the coastal areas of the disputed islands. President Dmitry Medvedev ordered officials to stay alert in case of new waves and said that Russia would offer assistance to Japan. Seismic expert Pyotr Shebalin was quoted as saying that there was a strong likelihood that the Japanese quake would trigger powerful quakes on Kamchatka or the Kurils, the disputed islands, over the next 9 months. And as far as I know, this has not happened. Also within hours, the President of Russia sent a telegram to Prime Minister Khan expressing his condolences and support. So on the one hand, officially, the Russian government expressed sympathy for Japan, support for Japan, but on the other hand, they overreacted, at least in retrospect, to the Japanese disaster, but understandably so. Russia dispatched a 260-man strong rescue team to Japan, which was very well received by the Japanese people in the disaster area. On March 12th, Prime Minister Putin met with Deputy Prime Minister Igor Sechin and Director General of Rosatom, which is in charge of atomic energy in Russia, Sergei Kiryenko, and issued two messages to be conveyed to Japan. One, Japan is a country friendly to Russia. Japan is a neighbor. So over the longer term, we do need to get along with Japan. At this moment of need for the Japanese people, we will do what we can to help them. Secondly, look for opportunities for Russia to exploit in terms of Japan's immediate needs for alternative sources of energy. Seeing that Japan is going to move away from nuclear energy reliance towards alternative energy sources. But of course, Russia, alternative energy sources basically mean oil and natural gas. So there are playing real politic game, and also showing sympathy for the Japanese. I'd like to just mention very briefly one fairly recent statement by a Russian foreign minister who said that the peace treaty is perhaps not necessary for the two countries to get along. This is truly remarkable because the peace treaty is what both governments have agreed is necessary in order for the two countries to normalize relations fully and to move on into the 21st century. Now, the high-level Russian government official is saying perhaps peace treaty is not necessary, which means Russia is entertaining the possibility that the resolution of the territorial dispute is not coming or doesn't have to come for the two countries to get along. And in this, I see a real politics calculation on the part of Moscow, in that they saw Japan humiliate itself, expose its vulnerability towards China, when last September there was a trawler incident close to Senkaku Island, Diaoyu in Chinese, when the Japanese Coast Guard ship was rammed into by a trawler owned by Chinese. And the Japanese government placed the captain of the trawler under Japanese custody. And they were going to proceed with legal charges against him. But for some reason, I think political pressure, they decided to release this captain to the dismay and frustration of Japanese citizens. And the Chinese trawler captain went back to China a hero. And I remember him saying, if I have another chance, I will do it again. So Russia and China are trying to deepen their strategic partnership, taking advantage of this particular humanitarian problem that Japanese government is facing. I'm sorry I've run out of my time. Usurped my time already, so I'll stop here, and if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to entertain them. Thank you.
Fascinating comments. Thank you very much. We're now entering the question portion, and we do have some questions up here, but if anyone has any additional cards, please pass them to our host out in the audience. First question, an economics question, but it's an interesting fact that 18 of the 54 nuclear plants in Japan are active at the moment. Most are closed either due to disaster or a concern about reopening them by the local prefectures. And there are brownouts, conservation of electricity, and the summer season hitting. And the question is, what is the effect of lack of electricity in Japan going to do to the economy, and how does it get fixed in a reasonable period of time? Stephen, I'm gonna lay that one on you.
Well, thanks for starting with an easy question. I think the Japanese government has to toe a fine line between making sure that there's adequate energy to keep the economy moving and also addressing the public's real concerns about the safety of nuclear power. My hunch is that within that balance, that they would put a premium on keeping factories moving, right? In other words, keeping the economy going. And part of it depends on who's in power, because obviously Khan, as I suggested, is deeply suspicious of the electric power industry, and so he would lean on the side of caution in terms of allowing these plants to operate. And he got a lot of points from the public by closing one of the most suspect plants that really had been questioned about its safety. And he said, we're going to close this. Having said that, so I guess my point is that I think that the government will do its best to make sure that power operates. Scheduled brownouts may not be totally disruptive. Obviously, it gets beyond that, right? You're talking about a much higher level of a disruption when there's plants and hospitals that can't operate because they didn't know that there was critical operations that really need 24-hour electricity don't get it, then you've got a bigger problem. So my sense is that the government would do what it can to keep things operating. I think what's going to be trickier even than that is looking longer term and figuring out how are they going to, keep Japanese power. And the Prime Minister is on record saying that he wants to move towards renewables, but even the Prime Minister isn't saying, let's get rid of nuclear energy. So the question of how to make it safe is going to be on the Japanese agenda. And I think Japan is one country that is not going to do, it's not going to follow Germany. It's not going to say, let's see if we can move away from nuclear energy. It's going to say, let's pursue some other options. Let's shift the balance. But nuclear energy is likely here to stay in Japan, and they're going to have to figure out how to make it safe.
Thank you. Dr. Barron, we have a reconstruction question, the bad insurance company question. How quickly and to what extent are insurance providers assuming losses and deploying distributing claims? And is the government involved in any manner in putting pressure on the insurance companies to increase their pace of distributing cash to the victims?
I don't know the specific answer to that question. My guess is that Japanese insurance companies have the same Natural Disaster Act of God caveats that American insurance companies have. The Japanese government has announced a program of compensation for people who have whose homes were totally destroyed, but not for people whose homes were partially destroyed. So I think this is a very unresolved issue. It's a major issue that has yet to be worked out. This cannot be solved by insurance companies alone in any case, whatever the specific response to that question is.
Thank you. Dr. Kaha, clearly the U.S.-China relationship has become the largest bilateral relationship in the world and somewhat has usurped Japan. And the question involves, going back to some of the discussions you were having about what has China done to work with Japan in the crisis, and what is the strategy perhaps of China and with Japan on East Asian relations going forward? Is this a catalytic moment?
Thank you. Chinese leadership has been engaged in what we call smile diplomacy for close to 10 years now. And this has given an opportunity for the Chinese leadership to continue to exercise that, perhaps more actively, more explicitly vis-a-vis Japan, by showing to the Japanese people and the government that the Chinese people and the Chinese government do care about Japan and about their bilateral relationship. But as I suggested, unfortunately, at least for the Chinese side, the inability of the Japanese government opened up a greater opportunity for the Americans, for the American government, to insert itself in a positive way into the protection of Japanese security, safety, and perhaps even future energy development in terms of technology transfer, technology sharing between the two countries. And on the political front, Japan and China are still on a very, very touchy level. There is an expression in Japanese which is roughly translatable as hot economics, cold politics, characterizing the Japan-China relationship. And I think that relationship, uneven relationship between the political and the economic side, will continue. I'd like to touch upon the very first question that was raised, that Stephen answered, and turned into an even a bigger question. That is, when Japan's energy supplies are short, there are two solutions to them. Somehow fill the gaps and expand the supply of energy to the same level as pertained previously. The other option, which very few people have entertained, is to live with the reduced level of energy consumption, meaning Japanese living standards will decline somewhat, but not so precipitously that each individual will physically suffer the consequences. And that scenario ties into the idea that Japan can be a smaller economic power and smaller political power, but still maintain its cultural integrity. And perhaps by happenstance, Japan will be less of a threat to its neighboring countries, including China. And that scenario, I think, is going to be entertained by more people among the Japanese public who have sort of decided that, yes, we can actually live on 15% less energy than we used to consume. And the resilience of the Japanese people that they have demonstrated already tells me that if push come to shove, they should be able to do it.
Thank you. Dr. Vogel, being as how it appears the Prime Minister changes in Japan every 13 or 14 months, to address the issue of weak political leadership, should Japan form a new way to elect a Prime Minister? Interesting question.
Well, the Japanese Prime Minister is not directly elected. It's a parliamentary system, so there's a parliamentary election, and then the parliament elects the Prime Minister. The logic of a parliamentary system is that the Prime Minister always, by definition, has a majority within the parliament, because it's that majority that elects the Prime Minister. So it should be easier to get things done in a parliamentary system than it is, for instance, in a presidential system like the United States, where you can have divided government. Without getting into the complexities of the Japanese electoral system, Japan has its own version of divided government right now, because while the government has a majority in the lower house, it does not have a majority in the upper house. So they have kind of divided government Japanese style, which is one of the reasons you get the gridlock, why it's so hard for the government to do anything, and why they're talking about a grand coalition, because it would be a solution. Because if they had a grand coalition, then you've got a majority, obviously, in both houses, and you can pass bills. What I was suggesting in my earlier comments was that doesn't really solve the problem, because you still have to agree on what you're going to do, which means negotiations between those two big parties. So back to the heart of the question. My answer would be no, and the logic would be as follows. Just changing the way you elect the Prime Minister, you could argue that it would make a difference in the sense that a Prime Minister, which I guess wouldn't be a Prime Minister anymore, it would be a President, would have an electoral mandate in the way that an American president does, and in a way that a Japanese Prime Minister doesn't, because the Japanese public could say, well, we didn't elect this guy, right? And the Prime Minister can't really say, well, I have a mandate to serve the public because they've elected me, because they didn't. Still, if we look, for example, we compare Prime Minister Khan to Prime Minister Koizumi, which wasn't that long ago. That was 2001 to 2006. You had a much stronger prime minister, and you had a more effective one, because that strong prime minister was using certain administrative powers that had actually increased over the past decade or so. There's been a variety of administrative reforms. Again, I won't bore you with the details, but basically strengthening the cabinet office, the Japanese equivalent of the White House staff, was given more power, which means that the right prime minister actually can exercise some leadership. Now, I'm not an unbridled fan of Koizumi. I think because I don't think everything he did was actually good, and B, I think he's given more credit than he actually deserves, because a lot of the things that he did were already in the pipeline, and he left a lot of the messy work to his successors, and as you know, it did get very messy. But still, having said that, I think it helps to address this question, because it says that it's not the Japanese constitution that's the problem, right? It's how it's exercised, right? It's who is the prime minister. If the right person is the prime minister, they could get things done, right? The Japanese constitution allows that. A strong prime minister would have a parliamentary majority and could exercise it with the administrative powers that have been strengthened over the past 10 or 15 years. Which leaves, right, of course, the big question, which is how do we get from here to there? And I think all we know is that Prime Minister Khan himself is probably not going to do it. It's going to have to be the next prime minister or the one after that who will solve this problem, hopefully.
Thank you very much. You know, the next question, there were several people had ties to this, and it basically is about, and this is directed to you, Dr. Barron, why... The culture of the U.S. of NGOs is deep, and the culture of giving is deep. And I think there was a lot of discussion of the U.S. coming over in big ways to Japan. And the culture of NGOs in Japan, I believe you mentioned, was limited. So could you talk about the cultural differences in the nonprofit beliefs of Japan versus the U.S.?
There could be a very long answer to that. I'd say the short answer rests on the history of our different countries. The United States is a relatively young country. De Tocqueville, found in 1806, 1804, 1805, published in 1806, that Americans form associations at the drop of a hat. The fact of the matter is that as the American government expanded westward, it often followed settlers who by necessity had to set up their own postal service, their own schools, their own medical care, and the government follows. And so the United States has a long history of citizens taking action themselves out of necessity. In Japan, and I would say more generally in East Asia, you have strong historical governments that have always been centralized and in which the citizen was expected to be a subject of the government as opposed to a leader of the government. So for historical reasons, there has never been that sense of citizen autonomous association. That is relatively new across East Asia. It's not just Japan. But I would say more globally, the U.S. is not the model. The U.S. is the exception. Our civil society, the extent to which people do things autonomously, is really quite unique. So it isn't that the Japanese alone have somehow missed the mark. This is an American phenomenon that has spread and exists to some extent elsewhere. But East Asia has always been characterized by strong states, many of them effective, and certainly the Japanese government has been effective. And citizens expect the government to do things that in the U.S., the U.S. is the only country where presidential candidates run by being anti-governmental or against the system. That just doesn't happen in strong centralized states. And Japan is one of those many strong centralized states.
Thank you for that detailed answer. Unfortunately, we are out of time. And so on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I would like to thank Dr. Tsuneo Akaha, Dr. Barnett Barron, and Dr. Stephen Vogel for providing us with their thoughts and insights. Thank you and good night.